our next panel can come on up, but I have noticed that in the new paradigm of these, what I call sell and sue cases, where they sell all the assets under 363 and the banks come out, and all that's generally left is a bunch of lawsuits. I noticed this a few years ago, and that's when I changed law firms to a contingent fee law firm. And the problem with this is that you have to find a firm that doesn't represent banks, because in almost every one of these great and that's what we do is contingent fee cases. In almost every one of these, you wind up suing some bank for something. So I guess our...
I have a plug for the wine.
Yeah.
The two white wines, as well as the reds, will be some of the best wines you've ever had in your life. They're Chevalier Monarchie La Cabotte and Meursault Perrier from 2006 Bouchard. If you haven't tried them, if you love white wine and red wine, come. You'll be missing something if you don't. Sorry for the plug.
No. And I'm going to get a plasma stand and an IV for that last one there. Our last panel for the morning is going to talk about, while they're taking their seats, family offices. I don't know much about family offices, because it requires, as I understand it, a net worth of about $100 million to get one going. But I do see that in virtually every one of these distressed cases, there's some family that has a piece of it. It's because I think the goal of many of these is to not lose money. And they figure they need to be hedged, and so they love distressed debt. Adam Harris is with Schulte, Roth & Zabel, and he's on that firm's executive committee. He's been in many, many of the major cases in the last decade or two, including the lenders in Pope Talbot and in Delphi, one of the purchasers there of assets. He has represented the largest mortgage holder in the extended stay. He has appeared, I think, in most of the major Delaware and New York cases. Paul Rubin with Herrick Feinstein is with us, who I think ran into the first time, representing a secured lender in General Growth Properties, which was no Mickey Mouse case. In Circuit City, he represented the winning bidder for the real estate there. And in Taylor Bean Whitaker, he represents the DIP lender, and he has, I think, successfully reorganized that company. Ira Perlmutter is works with a family office. He's the managing director of Trenwith's Cove Capital Investors, and that's a turnaround advisory firm that advises over $6 billion in assignments for J.P. Morgan and the Korea Exchange Bank. Prior to founding Cove Capital, which advises family offices, he was vice president of Chase Manhattan's restructuring group, where he restructured and sold over $1.5 billion of troubled debt. Samuel Brill is with Wiseman Capital, LLC. His CV in the book doesn't say what that family office does, but I understand that it owns the Mall of Americas. I've got you. Well, that's what we explain why it isn't on your CV. So Ira does manage, own this is the family office does own Mall of Americas.
That's correct.
And that's pretty impressive. Samuel is the Wiseman Capital's family office. I don't know what you own in a family office exactly, but I know that you were a director and chief operating officer of iMedia Networks, formerly TTR Technologies, and that had offices all over the world. And so I assume that had to do also with a family office that you were working with. Is that correct?
No, it was actually a hedge fund.
Well, then you guys, the interesting thing about these fellows working with family offices, they try to be opaque. They don't want to let you know who they really represent and how much money they've got. That's, I think, another characteristic. So I'll turn it over to you, Gabe.
Thanks, Hugh.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for coming to our panel today. Like Hugh, I think when I first got involved in this particular panel, I knew very little about what family offices were all about. Obviously, our firm represents a number of them in helping them set them up, but have never really been involved in their investing side of their businesses. But as it turns out, it's a obviously very large and very important segment of the investment community, and we're happy to be able to share some of the experiences and information about that area with you all today. As we go along during the course of our presentation today, if you have any questions, feel free just to raise your hand, and we'll call on people during the course of the presentation rather than holding it all to the very end. We're going to try and make this as iterative and interactive a process as possible rather than us just all sitting up here lecturing y'all on what family offices are all about. But to get the panel kicked off, I'm going to ask Ira and Sam just to talk a little bit about their individual, the family offices where they work, what they're kind of all about, and give us a little bit of background on that so we have a better sense and a platform from which to move on from there.
Thank you very much. I work for T5 Equity Partners, which is the private equity affiliate of the family that owns the Mall of America. I head all direct private equity investing for the family. We're industry agnostic, to some degree size agnostic, and we just look for, primarily I look for bankruptcy opportunities, companies, revenues, $10 to $100 million. But I also look at venture capital and other deals that the family's interested in.
And I'm Sam Brill. I'm the CIO and portfolio manager at Weissman Capital. We focus about a third of our book in public equities and credit, and the rest of the book is spread across outside managers like hedge funds, private equity, and we do direct investing in real estate and private companies.
So from the two very general descriptions we just got, we can see that family offices can be very, very different, even one from another, depending on what the focus is and the individual family and the type of investments they're going at. But, I mean, Ira, what do you think distinguishes family offices from other types of investors? What are some of the characteristics?
Some of the characteristics, and again, it depends on the family, and typically there's been a liquidity event in a family, and then they're looking to decide how to allocate, how to invest their funds. So sometimes they have a pure investment model where they serve as looking to invest in across a variety of funds. They're not doing direct deals. Other families take a more proactive interest in that, and they allocate a portion of their investing to doing direct deals that may be related to or unrelated to, or maybe actually a diversification or a hedge against their primary business. They come in all different sizes and shapes. I mean, there are very large family offices. The one that I work for is comprised of four brothers together, but there are all different types of iterations in the structure and size and what they look to do. There may be multi-generational family offices as well. So there are many different types of family office structures.
Well, our family office was created through public investing. The patriarch of the family really made all his money from public investing, so we started from that mold, and over time we've moved a great portion of the assets for diversification into other areas. And we're very value-driven, and we're very much focused on and have an emphasis on capital preservation over the magnitude of returns. We're not worried about monthly NAVs, so we have a longer time horizon, and we're willing to take the time and invest and make the investments to make sure that they're successful over time. We're not really geared to the same focus as many other types of investors.
Just to put it another way is that families are investing for generations, not for the next quarter, not to raise the next fund. It's for really for the grandchildren and great-grandchildren. So there's a much, much longer time horizon that can be used. And one thing that I see among a lot of families is that they'll make a small investment in a particular industry or area where there's some interest, and then once they get comfortable that they are okay operating in that milieu, they'll then look to grow in that particular sector or in that type of investment style as well.
I mean, Paul, you know, as somebody who represents family offices from a legal perspective, what are some of the sort of distinguishing features that you see in terms of the role you play and the advice you give?
I've represented family offices with regard to 363 sales, acquiring assets through confirmed Chapter 11 plans of reorganization. I represented them with regard to refinancings, with regard to acquisitions or secondary acquisitions once they're already in a particular space, and also with regard to putting to bed an investment that went sour and they didn't want to have a formal proceeding. And what I see, one of the challenges from the lawyer's perspective is that there's a good chance your client is going to be looking at or working in a number of different industries where you don't have hands-on experience, and you're going to have to be very careful with regard to due diligence, with regard to looking at peculiar laws that affect the industry or that apply in the states in which they are working. That's one piece of it. I also find that family offices are idiosyncratic, and you really have to understand your client and understand the dynamics of how it's working. So, for example, you may have multiple generations who are involved in the business, actively involved in the investment decision-making process. And there may be certain amounts of tension. There may be different attitudes with regard to one family. So, for example, I mentioned one company went south. That was one part of the family. One member was in charge of that particular business. You have to wonder, what are the other members of the family thinking? And are we going to give that individual an opportunity again? In that specific instance, I can say we had trouble with a company in 2007. That same family member is now actively involved with a company that's highly successful and getting a lot of very good publicity at this point in time. But publicity is another unique issue, because a lot of family offices don't want publicity. They don't want to be in the limelight. And that's another factor as the lawyer that you're going to have to think about when working for them.
Now, in a lot of investment funds, there's an obvious sort of investment committee structure. The investment committee approves a particular deal that's brought to them. Can each of you sort of comment on, from a family office perspective, how that decision-making and governance works, whether it's, you know, one patriarch of the family or matriarch of the family says, we're doing this deal, or whether it's a much more, I suspect, a much more difficult decision than that?
Well, for us, it evolved over time. I think initially it was the patriarch. He made the final decisions, and you would have multiple family members, you know, giving their opinion about how they felt about a specific type of investment and concerns, and then ultimately he would make the decision. I think over time, as he got older, it became more of a committee approach without having that tiebreaker. That decision was no longer in his hands, so it became more of a committee approach, and that, I think, didn't necessarily work well because there wasn't a tiebreaker and everybody sort of was equal members, and that's how it sort of evolved to having the investment. Basically, they nominated myself as the tiebreaker, since I wasn't part of the family and I can look at things objectively. And then now we don't even have the same approach, actually. We have different sections of the family office that present different types of ideas, whether it's the one focuses on real estate, another focuses on private equity, and then another focuses on public investments.
For the family that I work for, it's pretty streamlined. Generally, they'll follow my recommendation. If I want to do a deal, they'll follow along. There's not a lot of paperwork, not a lot of bureaucracy with it. There'll be some presentations that keep them appraised of what's going on all along the process. But it's a very streamlined process. But I would say that in many families, this becomes a difficult issue. You have sometimes a senior family member that's unwilling to give over the reins. You have the younger kids that are in their 20s and 30s that have started to actually been successful on their own, and then they want to do something and they run into problems with the senior generation that maybe they don't like that industry, they're not familiar with technology, they are uncomfortable with that. So it can be an issue, and that's an important point to evaluate when dealing with a family office, is to make sure that you're dealing with somebody who really has access or is the decision maker, so that you don't end up spending a lot of time thinking you're going to get something done and then don't.
If I can add.
Sure.
My experience is that this often leads to a requirement to have the same discussion within the family several times. Many family offices are going to hire an outside non-family member, like the gentleman on this panel, professionals who are seasoned, who can vet the deals, find the opportunities. Then there's going to be an explanation, but there's going to be, more likely than not, there's going to be more than one member of the family who's going to need to hear that explanation and need to be convinced. So I may have to give the same conversation about a strategy or about an opportunity a few times. Also, a lot of times with family offices, the families are spread out. I may be dealing with people in a lot of different time zones. There's a very good chance we're going to have, it's going to slow us down a little bit. It's not like dealing with a hedge fund client or a private equity client where they have streamlined procedures and no one feels a family prerogative to be able to say, well, I didn't hear this yet. Within the family office, you really have to be sensitive to those personalities and know what you need to accomplish in order to get yourself over the finish line.
Yeah, I mean, in preparing for today, guys, we talked a little bit about, you know, some of the benefits of dealing with family office investors, and one of the things we talked about was sort of speed of decision making and flexibility of terms and things like that. Ira, maybe you can comment on how the discussion we just had about the potential internal dovetails with the benefit of family offices, which, you know, generally is more expedited decision making, and how do you present that to your borrower or the company in which you're making an investment so they have certainty of this is going to move forward promptly?
Sure. We, you know, as I mentioned, we have a very expedited process, although, again, it's taken some time to build to that level, you know, because one of the key issues in dealing with family offices is the issue of trust. Everybody is trying to get in their wallet, and so they want to be sure that they're getting the best advice possible. But in terms of decision making, once you're able to get a process going, and ours is very streamlined, we can move very, very quickly. And to a point, the family is willing to be much more creative in terms of deal structures. They can take less money now. They can offer better incentives to management and other stakeholders because they're looking, again, for the long term. So they're not necessarily short-sighted in terms of trying to buy something and sell it quickly and make a flip on it. They're longer-term type of investors. So there's a lot more flexibility, a lot more creativity. Sometimes there's even a willingness to pay more for something than you think is prudent, than I would think is prudent. And many times I play the role of saying, I think that would be too much. You know, we shouldn't do that.
Yeah, I think quick decision-making is probably our biggest differentiator. We could turn around a deal probably within a week. Again, we too are very, very flexible when it comes to the structure of the deal. So we can negotiate different terms. And if it's strategic with another company that we own, then in those cases, we generally can pay more because it makes sense. But it really depends on who you're working with. And I think it's extremely important that we're not going to turn around a deal that somebody brought us that we don't know. If we don't know you, that's going to take a lot more time because we're not just doing due diligence on the deal, we're doing due diligence on you. And so deals like that will take considerably longer. But people who we know or people we've done deals with in the past, those can be very quick turnarounds.
And I would say, just in contrast, I field calls, and actually my name for many years was the only name on the family office website, and so I would get all kinds of calls, emails, you know, selling me the latest, you know, brand of sliced bread. And I'm willing to take a look at it, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, but we are willing to look in any industry or any type of deal, any type of structure. You know, clearly we say no to the majority of them, but we are willing to look at it, especially where there may be some relationship to something that we already know or have an expertise in. And so we are more flexible, I would say, in that regard. Although, again, the majority still is no, so we still get to the same place. But
To the extent you're comfortable and not constrained by any kind of confidentiality, could you just give a couple examples of deals where, you know, the flexibility in terms of the structure, the ability to move quickly, or the deal structure benefited the family office investor versus what maybe another type of fund would have been able to do or not do?
Well, we had a deal that I worked on that we had won a 363 sale, and we were not the stalking horse, but we outbid them, and the stalking horse kind of had sour grapes, and they sued to try and block us from closing. And I was on a plane, you know, on the tarmac, and we needed to wire the money out, and it was time of the essence, and I was on the phone with two sets of lawyers and the family and everything, and they said, should we wire the money? And we didn't have our bank financing done yet. We didn't have our health insurance and employees done yet, but which we did take care of course. But I told the family, just wire the money. It's okay. We're going to get refied and wire the money. And then, you know, the stewardesses tapped me on the shoulder, sir, I'm sorry, you really need to shut that phone out. Like, it's okay. Go ahead and wire the money. And they did it. You know, and so there it can be that flexibility and the ability to move very quickly where, you know, in other instances, there would have been a lot more roadblocks to getting something done.
I can't really speak publicly about some of the private deals we've done, mostly the public side investment, which I don't think really differentiates us. I don't think we're very differentiated in that field. We're very similar to a hedge fund right. In that regard. If I were to talk about something, there's a real estate deal that we recently did where we bought an office building in Dallas. And I think that was an example of someone we had worked with before. We'd done deals with them before, and they were running the GP of that deal, and they needed to bring in more equity from the GP side. They already had the LPs set up, but in order for them to get that deal done, they needed more of a GP participation. And so they brought us in as a GP partner, and we were able to turn that deal around in less than a week.
Just another example, if I could, is we were looking at a company that was in deep financial distress. It wasn't in bankruptcy, and they needed money to pay their insurance to be able to continue to operate. And I was willing to sign a letter with them that we would pay their insurance, even though we had not done, we didn't have an asset purchase, we didn't have anything. I tried to tie them up as best I could in that letter. Fortunately, in the end, some due diligence came out, and I was able to scooter by it. But we are willing to be very creative and put in money in interesting ways, fast.
Paul, is the sometimes the lawyer is the face of the family office to opposing counsel and either the borrower or the company in which the investment's being made. I mean, what are some of the challenges that you run into in terms of questions that are presented to you or issues that are presented to you about, you know, the borrower or the company getting comfortable with the family office type investor?
Well, there are a few factors. One of them is you have to understand that family office investors, they are extremely patient. They are willing to look at deals and pass and pass and pass and say no 100 times before they actually do go ahead with a deal. When they find the deal, they'll want to jump in and do it quickly, but they are very selective. And we may be dealing with trustees or brokers, those have been retained by order of the court, financial advisors, asking, is your client for real? And I've said no so many times. And I have to actually convince them, yes, these guys really do pull the trigger. They have pulled the trigger several times. But you've got to keep in mind what their attitude is. That's one thing. Another factor is simply that you want to be reasonable. And it's typical when you have negotiations, each side is going to leave something on the table. And again, you really have to know who the party is that you're dealing with, because I have to explain sometimes with regard to one particular client that when we talk about leaving something on the table, my clients want to take the table. And
your clients are unique.
But I'm just upfront as best I can to tell people that to know what they are. Look, these are the guys with the money, and in distress situations in particular. Chapter 11 has become largely an M&A practice. It is much more rare for us to see cases where the company files and they sit down and they negotiate with their trade creditors and they work something out with the secured lender and they bring in the restructuring advisors who fix things and then they come out of bankruptcy again, all right? We have crash and burning. We have crashed and burnt. We have these acute needs for funding to have a 363 sale process very quickly. So the family office, on the one hand, is a tremendous area that the brokers, that the financial advisors and debtors want to find, that everyone wants to bring. But you have to understand also that these people are going to be very, very careful and selective in what they do. So it's kind of like a tight wire act that I'm playing in these situations.
And just if I could, is that part of my strategy is to joint venture with other families. Right now, the area of direct investing is very, very hot in the family office world. I'm speaking at three conferences, you know, in the next several weeks about this very same topic. So families are very intensely interested in doing direct deals. They feel that they have not gotten a fair shake from some of their fund investments. They want to be able to have more control. They want to work with other families that they can trust. However, I've had a number of deals where I was working with another family to try and do a deal, and because they don't have to do a deal, they can just sort of let it happen or not happen on their own schedule. And that can be very frustrating because you think, okay, we're going to do this. They've given you all the indicia that it is going to happen. And you come down to the wire and, well, I've got to go on vacation next week. I don't think I can get back to you. I'm like, whoa. You know, we're buying this thing at 2.5 times EBITDA here. You know, sometimes it just doesn't make a difference. So,
Sam, maybe you started to talk a little bit earlier about, you know, the family office starting out mostly at public equities, because that's where the patriarch of the family had made most of the money, and investing in funds and spreading the money around. But talk a little bit about the distressed investing philosophy, the strategy, and how it's evolved over time, if it has.
Well, I don't think we did any distressed investing when we started. It was actually just public equities, and then we sort of started to look at credit. And we were putting a lot of money with hedge funds and private equity because I don't think the patriarch was yet comfortable doing those deals, even though we had the expertise and the skills to do it. Because I came from that type of, I was a COO of a public company prior to that, but worked at a hedge fund and had the whole investment. So I've been on both sides of the table. But it took some time and conditioning, and I think seeing some deals happen with, first in conjunction with some private equity funds where we did some side-by-side investing in some of the deals that we liked in particular. We wanted to increase the exposure to that specific idea. And then over time, we started to branch out and look at, first we started looking at private deals in order to have more diversification, have something that actually generates cash flow, something that you can feel and touch. And once he got comfortable with that, we kind of moved on to the next level. And then 2008 happened, and all of a sudden there was a slew of distressed opportunities, and we had the liquidity, and frankly we didn't have enough bandwidth to look at everything that was coming our way. And that's really when we expanded into a lot of distressed opportunities, pre-bankruptcies, post-bankruptcies, private companies that were just ran out of cash or couldn't get a credit line. And it was extremely, all of those investments from that time period were, you know, successful because of the time period. It was just nobody else had money. So I think after that happened, we were very comfortable with doing that, and we kind of start to focus on that. And now there's not nearly as many deals, but there are still plenty of deals to be done.
Related to Sam's point, I think an important point for anybody bringing a deal to a family office is you want to make sure they have experience doing deals. They might own a great company, a big company, but if they don't have deal experience or they don't have distressed experience, you can end up spending a lot of time. And when I first started working for the family I'm working for, I only found out after the fact, but that the first 2 years I was on a trial basis, and I had this, I had this amazing deal at 1.7 times EBITDA. It was a wallpaper manufacturer, and I made the mistake of saying, well, come, let's go see the factory, which was very close to where we were, and they came in and were totally spooked out. There's this cotton dust flying everywhere. The machinery looks like it's from the 1940s, and they weren't that excited about it. I said, it's 1.7 times EBITDA. I said, you know, we could wallpaper the Mall of America and make 5 times the money on this thing. But in any event, so you want to make sure you're dealing with an experienced family office. In general, I would say it's important that they have an outside or a person that's worked in some field that can sort of carry the ball and get a deal done, because otherwise you can spend a lot of time thinking you're going to get a deal done.
I'm going to bounce to a related subject, even though it's not technically in the order we talked about before, which is, you know, when you talk about this kind of diversity of investments, are there any sort of, you know, mandatory things that you guys insist upon in terms of deal, whether it's control, non-control, board seats, you know, cash flow? Are there any sort of things that are kind of conditions or things that you need to have in any given deal?
I think cash flow number one, EBITDA at least, even if you aren't cash flow positive, and there needs to be a path to that profitability. If there isn't, then it's not going to make a lot of sense. In terms of control, it really depends on the size of the deal. We're comfortable with non-control deals as long as we have board representation and some sort of other controls within the deal, like blocking certain dividend payments or other types of payouts to the other investors. But in those situations, we're usually partnered with somebody that we know and are comfortable with. So I don't think the control is an issue for us. It's just about the investment itself and the people.
I would say control is a bigger issue for, I don't know about for the family, but for me it's a bigger issue, is I like to have control. I've done a lot of workouts. I come out of the workout business, and I like to know that I have a hand on the reins some way or the other. But there are a lot of families that, surprisingly enough, we'll go into very speculative deals and fund them for years and years and put a lot of money in. I usually like to comment about year 5 or 7 and see what I could do.
Sure, go ahead.
With regard to the issue of control, I find that the family office really needs to be comfortable with whoever is or is going to be running the company. When we're talking about the distressed space, there's a suspicion already that existing management has done something wrong and needs to be replaced, otherwise they wouldn't be in this situation. That may or may not be a fair criticism. There may be external factors that affected a good company that they couldn't control, but nevertheless, the family office is going to want to know that if they don't have voting control, they have to have tremendous confidence in who it is who's going to be running that company going forward.
Now, just follow up on that, Paul, in terms of kind of documenting the investment, whether it's an equity deal or a debt deal, do you find that that there are sort of pretty substantial negotiations over things like Sam was talking about, the ability of the company to pay dividends, replacement of senior management, what kind of board representation you get, what kind of transactions would be subject to supermajority voting, things like that?
I think a lot depends upon where we are. If we're already in a Chapter 11 proceeding or even a Chapter 7 proceeding, we have a lot more flexibility, especially if there's not a stalking horse bidder who's there ahead of us. If we're the first ones to the dance, we have a lot more say in what's going on. When we're talking about a situation where it's a distressed acquisition outside of bankruptcy, we're going to spend a lot of time with regard to due diligence issues and getting comfortable that we can do this acquisition outside of the chapter. We're going to want to understand what the debts are, the potential liabilities and exposures, because the business people are going to be asking me what could go wrong, and we're going to have a lot of conversations about fraudulent transfers and successor liability and things of that sort. And we're going to want to drill down pretty deeply with regard to those particular issues. And if we get past those, there's a very good chance that the family offices that I represent, at least, are going to have a very large say with regard to control.
And if I could add, in terms of control, when we're not in control situations, well, actually, just in general, we never do straight equity deals with private companies. It just never happens. You have to have a different structure than, or for us, you have to have a different structure than that. That will never, at best, maybe we'll do convertible debt, but you have to have that controls within that structure to make sure that you're not going to get taken advantage of.
Oh, there's a question.
Generation didn't really
Good luck. I mean, there are a number of sort of aphorisms in the family office world. You know, from clogs to clogs in three generations is one from Holland, shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves. I mean, there are, can be issues. I mean, in the family that I work for, I mean, it's very, you know, functional and very good working family. But there definitely are issues. And, you know, you have personalities and it's fueled by a lot of money. And, you know, Johnny kicked Sally when, you know, when he was six. And I've seen people still today, they're in their 30s, still fighting over, you know, that kick. And so you need to be very, you know, cautious, you know, and making sure that you are dealing with the right people at the family office. And I think that's one of the perhaps comforts of when you deal with a professional who's at a family office. There are people that know, you know, how things should work, and you can have some level of comfort that, you know, you're interfacing with people who know how things should work. So,
are you asking how we protect ourselves or personally?
Yeah.
We have internal controls and procedures in place to make sure that there aren't things like front running. I invest all my money side by side with the family. So I'm, in essence, sort of like a member in all the investments. I actually participate in every investment that we do, so I have the same exposure as they do. But in terms of I'm still not clear. You mean?
Well, I think there's two concerns. I mean, one is the concern, you know, you take on a dual relationship. On the one hand, you're finding deals. Okay? You basically find deals, and you're investing in them. On the other hand, you're acting also sort of as a financial advisor to that family and saying, this is a good thing. I'm in that deal. Is might, you know, shows confidence that, you know, you have money at risk. On the other hand, it could be, well, you know, I got 10 other families in to buttress my stake in an offering. So, you know, the question arises, or maybe a mean-spirited lawyer like me gets involved at some point and says, wait a second, who's the client? Who's the client? And is there an arm's length? And is there a responsibility that you have to the client to say, wait a second, you're just chasing yield. You know, the first generation was great, but you don't know what you do. Okay? You know, it's those kinds of issues that, you know, where it gets fuzzy.
We have investment management agreement with all the family entities. So every and within that, there's all kinds of indemnification and I guess protection for myself. But at the same time, we have a committee approach, so everybody is aware, especially in the public deals. The public equity book is separate, so it's almost like we're invested in a hedge fund. We happen to manage that hedge fund, and there's separate deal documents for that. But for bigger deals or for private deals, it's a committee approach. Everyone in the family is aware of that deal, and they vote on the deal. And, you know, their votes are on record. And their concerns are always taken into consideration. But at the end of the day, everyone is aware of the deals that have been done, and everything is full disclosure. But again, we're you know, second/third generation right now. So I'm sure as the family, as the generations continue, you have more and more people you're trying to please, and the more there are, the harder it is.
If I may. One of the things that the family office tends to do is invest with other family offices. That gives them a certain level of comfort that the deal that they're going into is something that others have also independently vetted and are going in with. So that's a feature. A second factor is a lot of, to me, the more prudent family office members, the relatives, are going to be themselves staying involved and engaged in the process, as opposed to just trusting one person and there's a black box. And the third is one of the phenomena you'll also see. There are a lot of attorneys in my office who have a specialty called business divorce. You do have family offices where the second, third generation, they don't necessarily see eye to eye, and they just decide to part. Hopefully it's going to be amicably, and they're going to part because they may have the different philosophies or strategies, or they may have different levels of confidence in an industry or in individuals.
I'm going to make one more comment, then we'll take a question over here. But There's two issues in my mind that your question raises. One is the initial setup of the office, the governance structure, the management of the investment committee, how that gets set up, and to go to Sam's point, making sure that those who you know who are arguably the beneficiaries of the family office, both for themselves and for generations to come, are involved in that process and have to affirmatively review the deal, make sure they're getting the information they need, similar to what you would see in any kind of board of directors or board of managers for a limited liability company or corporation. The other issue, which is becoming more and more interesting not only in the family office space but also in the hedge fund and private equity space, is succession planning. What happens when the founder of the fund decides it's time to retire, either voluntarily or otherwise? And how is that fund going to perpetuate itself under the next generation of managers? And to try and build that in advance, you can always do it structurally, but personality and competence almost always take precedence over any kind of structure. So if it turns out your next generation are not a group of individuals who are particularly enamored of business or don't have much in the way of business acumen, that can create a serious kind of issue. Question was over here.
Thank you. I actually have two questions. On the governance question that was just raised, you mentioned earlier about a tiebreaker. Do you introduce the concept into your committees of a trust protector or distribution advisor if you're serving as an individual, or are you just known as the tiebreaker?
I hate when I'm the tiebreaker. so we try to win unanimity before we get into that type of situation. And sometimes I'll shy away from doing a deal just because it is, you know, if it's not, if I don't have 150% confidence that we're going to make a lot of money, even if we're going to make a return on the deal, I have confidence we'll make a low double-digit return, I might not pursue it because it's just not worth the fight. So I forgot the first part of your question.
Distribution advisor. How do you get tied into it from a titling perspective?
Well, frankly, trustees are extremely expensive, and they don't really do a lot. It's all CYA. Just being straight honest, that's what I find. They don't really make any decisions whatsoever, I find. Everything's very bureaucratic, and because we have trusts where we have corporate trustees, and the corporate trustees are very, they just want to collect their fee and they don't want to get involved. They don't get involved in the fight. Oh, if somebody doesn't agree, I'm sorry, we're not going to do anything. So I don't find that to be generally useful.
And I had a second question. How prevalent is it to have a human capital committee where you do training for the next generation? How important is that to psychological impact of well training?
I think it's extremely important. You know, we had the second generation, we had one family member that was trained in investing. You know, he got his MBA from NYU, not Columbia, went to NYU. And he's very, I would say, the people turn to him for some of the decision making. And some of the other family members that were not trained in investing, they have a completely different idea of what we should be investing in. And it's not coming from with any investment acumen, and that could be frustrating at times.
Just a quick anecdote on that, and we're going to move on to another area here. I was speaking with a financial advisor who's principal area of advising is high net worth individuals, and he was telling me about a seminar that his firm ran actually for the children of his clients, usually in the age group of about 15 or 16 to 25. And the question he put to his clients before he invited their kids in was, how much have you told your children about how much they're worth? And it was, the answer he said was very interesting. It was all over the map. Some people were full disclosure about what the family was really worth in terms of, you know, total value. And some had told their children absolutely nothing and had them on $1.95 a week allowances, basically So they didn't get used to the idea that they could just go out and pull out their gold card or their platinum card anytime they wanted to. So it's kind of an interesting concept of how generationally you train somebody to become the next, you know, the next generation of a wealthy family, when you're at the same time trying to instill morals and values in them at a very young age. And I don't know if that has any resonance with either of you two in terms of the families you work with.
Doesn't really have relevance necessarily to the family that I work with, but I've seen in a lot of families, I mean, this is clearly an issue. There are many conferences devoted to how do you properly prepare the next generation for that, how do you prepare them for philanthropy, and many things like that. But I was talking to a European family office, when it was actually the son, and he's running the business. One brother is off, you know, on a Porsche and a yacht. The other one is tree-hugging, as he called it. And, you know, all the headaches of the business are on his head. But in the meantime, he has all the liability. And so his thinking, you know, kind of much like Sam was saying, is that he just wants to sell and, you know, they'll divide the money and he can look after his own interests instead of being a nice ripe target for, you know, so.
Before we run out of time here, one of the things we did want to discuss was basically how family offices source deals, and to talk a little bit about, you know, if you're making an approach to a family office, what's the going to be the highest, what is it they're looking for in terms of information to sort of maximize the probability of getting a deal done. So Sam and Ira, if you could just talk a little bit about how you source your deals, maybe give some examples and what kind of information you guys would like to see for people who are approaching family offices with investment opportunities.
In terms of sourcing, we're pretty private, so we don't really have people fishing and, you know, cold calling us. And if we do, we generally don't really get very far. But it's mostly, it's very much relationship based, whether it's another family office or a side-by-side investment with a private equity fund, or just the investment banks that we work with on the equity and credit side, the public side, they're bringing us deals all the time as well. So we have more flow, I guess, than we could probably handle. And in terms of doing deal, in terms of actually having a deal really looked at and the best way to get us to focus is to be as short and concise as possible. You know, don't spend five pages talking about the company does all these great things without even putting numbers to it. And, you know, you're going to lose me in the second page, and I'm never going to finish the document. I'm never going to see the deal terms. I'm never going to see why do I want to make this investment. And I find that seems to be lost in a lot of deals that I see, where it's not really shortened to the point. In that first paragraph, you got to catch my attention. You got to show me right away why this is a great deal for me, why we're going to make money, why is this a company that I want to look at, and then give me some more details. But really, it shouldn't be more than a page to get all that in there, because that will bring my focus. And once you get past that hurdle, then you get into the details.
I would say that as well. I mean, if I have to ask how much money they're looking for, they haven't done their job. I mean, one short and sweet. I'm chairman of three companies that we own, chairman of the bank credit committee that I bought for the family. You know, and I don't have time to read, you know, prospectuses. Like, I want to just have a short summary of what the deal is. I would say an important thing is trust. Again, finding somebody who has relationships with families is very important. I referred a deal to a family, a broker to a family, and next thing I knew, they're doing a $150 million deal because I knew that family knew that space very well, and you know, they're supposed to close before the end of the year, hopefully. But I scan industry rags. You know, my primary focus is companies in distress or bankruptcy with revenues of 10 to 100 million, although I'll look smaller than that. So I look at the standard industry rags that come out, you know, in the distressed world. And people call me. I welcome the calls or emails and everything like that. Please write and or call. And, you know, again, we'll look at anything. I'll give you a pretty fast no if we're not interested in it. And that's what I look at. One other thing is that I'm a founder of the Clean Tech Family Office Syndicate, which is a group of a certain number of ultra high net worth families doing clean tech deals. There was a Wall Street Journal article about it. And part of the, again, the sort of underlying thesis there is it's only families. We're looking at deals together. There's no brokers. So if I ask a family that's been in the solar business, what do you think of these new solar panels? I know I'm getting a straight deal, and they may even be an investor, and I have a lot more confidence going into something like that than somebody sort of passing me a hot potato and trying to figure out, you know.
In real quick.
Sure.
I don't want to be the last thing between you all and lunch, but I thought the dichotomy between Sam and Ira here was very interesting. I think Sam is, his experience is much more common, that he's a little bit more closed, likes working with people that he's worked with in the past, very relationship-based. What Ira described is rather unique, that he is open to other suggestions from hearing from people that he has not dealt with in the past. Of course, there's going to be a lot of due diligence that's going to have to go along with that to become comfortable. And I think the key is going to be when you're making your pitch, there's going to be two stages. There's the teaser you're going to give, which has to be very easily explainable. And then if you have that meeting, if you have that 45-minute meeting, you're going to have to explain to these folks, how are you creating value for them? Why is it worth it?
Any other questions? Thank you all for coming this morning. Hope you enjoyed it.
Oh, absolutely. This is good.